So this is a continuation of yesterday's talk about rates. It's a paper we disenvolved, Philip Kozelowski and Chan-Wen Han, my graduate student in Oxford. So instead of the typical picture of Taiwan A, just put So yesterday we finished here, I think. This is the supernova rate from the SNS people. And they are saying that there's a small component of all time delays and a dominant component of short time delays. And this would be proportional to the self-formation history, depending on what to choose, and this is proportional to the mass. So this point is causing trouble. When this is confirmed, then we can really continue talking about rates, I think. Like at this moment, we are going to be waiting for that. So, so what's the idea? How can we derive the time delay of type 1 supernova, comparing the star formation history and the supernova rate? So, the main idea is to try to parameterize the time delay distribution with a typical time delay tau that gives you a supernova rate depending on redshift and the typical time delay. So this, very importantly, depends on the star formation history. And it's not, I don't think there's a big agreement on what the best star formation history is. And this is a parameterized time delay distribution that is arbitrary. You can use two components, you can use exponential, you can use power law, and try and see what happens. So then, you can take the number supernova you should see at the given redshift per solid angle. And this depends on this supernova rate, the effective time that you're looking at the supernova, so it's the total time times the probability of detecting the supernova, time duration factor, and cosmology. So then you use Bayes' theorem, and you conclude that the probability of the given time delay is proportional to this quantity. Or you can use a Boutin's of fit test. So this has been done, by Galliano and Mao, 2004, Stolgar et al, 2004, and Barris and Tomri as well, 2006. So what we, at the beginning, we saw the results were Stolgar et al, with this data point at high redshift, where there are no many supernova. Well, they were claiming that the time delays are the order of 4 GJ. So that will completely erase all the single layer channel, for instance, and other scenarios. But after a talk with Guillaume Blanc, now he's in Paris, he pointed out to us that some star formation histories follow better the short time delays compared to the supernova rate. So the star formation history is not. It's not an agreement between the optical, infrared, and possible record, etc. So here, just to show you different versions of the star formation history. This line and this line are the star formation histories using the Goetz field in supernova. This line is a star formation history derived from the cosmic infrared background. So basically, light is reprocessed as dust emission. And this line here is based on the fossil record, so in the nearby universe, you look at galaxies and try to reconstruct the main population of the galaxy. And these are based on 24-dimensional Spitzer data with different luminosity functions.
But nothing's dropping at 1.5. Even if you take all those weird ones.
No, none of them. Yeah. No, I think it's a problem with all of them. The drop.
You're gonna need a long delay in that one. If you want to take that point.
Yeah. So the main point for our paper is the position of this peak compared to the position of the supernova rate will determine the time delay. You just see here. What is the peak? I don't know. But here there are 3 years difference. So there's obviously going to be a strong dependence on the choice of star formation history and the time delay you derive. So here are some binary population synthesis time delays from Shanwen and Pozzolowski 2004. The double linear channel follows the power law given by the merging time of the two white dwarfs. The single linear channel is one possibly Gaussian or one peak given by the stable hydrogen burning in the single linear channel. And these are the functions, the parameterized functions used to constrain the time delays.
I thought I understood then when you said that. I was not sure I do, because as was being talked about yesterday or the day before, the total time delay is the progenitor's main sequence time scale, to which you add something like, I guess what you're saying here is that something that's kind of like a Gaussian, but that progenitor time scale is not a negligible part of this.
I don't know. This is from star formation to explosion.
This is from a star burst.
Yeah. Because to get the progenitor, if he's thinking it has to be a high mass white, star making, like a 6 or 7 solar mass star to make your massive white dwarf. That's not adding much.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But that's not the right time scale.
No, the time scale, I'm surprised at how short that is, because you do expect that some of the donor stars would be stars that may have 2 solar masses, for example.
Nine.
And so their time evolution scale, the time until they're ready to start giving mass to the white dwarf, would be a little bit longer. But maybe what you're saying is that in your population synthesis, these stars don't contribute anything.
That's the dotted curve. Huh? That's the ones with the superstars.
The solid curves, the double degenerates, that should have the shortest.
Because this delay is short dash dotted, simply because they put in the calculations stabilization events, which allows you to have more massive containers.
Right.
And short.
But there should still be some lower mass companions that do it too.
Lower mass companions contribute to longer.
Yeah, you can.
But they don't have any longer.
But I mean, you can compare this.
So funny, just remind us that there are 2 curves there that are actual population synthesis.
Yeah, this is same again. This is double the unit, and these are just arbitrary parametrizations, and they don't look much alike. That's one thing you notice. I mean, at least the exponential decay doesn't look too much like a power.
So what you're saying, the dash dotted curve contains both the main sequence lifetime and the time for the accretion to occur onto the white.
Yes.
For their population synthesis.
Yes, this is Shanwen 2004.
That's a super soft source channel with thermal mass transfer. Thermal mass transfer, you've got to have a higher mass donor. You can't do it at 10 gigahertz if that's the channel. That's all.
Yeah. This is CO plus main sequence source.
Right.
So this power law is what you will get if you don't take into account the main sequence, just assume that the distributions are flat, the separations are flat, and just take these formulas for the gravitational merging. So it's not very different from that.
How do you get that?
This is not true, but if you assume that the after common envelope, the distribution of separations is flat, you will get this power law. And in the population synthesis, you get something similar. So this is a common feature of all the double linear scenarios. And this is a common feature of the single linear CO plus main sequence. So just to remind you, these are the supernova from the Woods field. Just so you can see the redshift. These are taken from 2 fields, the Chandra Deep field south and Hubble Deep field north. And what Stronger et al. This is assuming Jabalisco et al. Star formation history, the optical correct, extinction-corrected optical self-formation history, use parameterized models, and derive the typical time delay. So what they conclude is that the typical time delay should be of the order of 3.5 gigayears. So it's very important result if it's true.
So then again, what's the goods, you know, weighting on ellipticals versus star-forming galaxies, blah, 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 blah? Because now you're going from just saying what's happening in star-forming galaxies or something, you're trying to compare, you know, what the typical thing is. So if we, as we saw earlier, typically these things are weighted by the ellipticals way, way, way too much, and that's just, you know, fitting to this curve means nothing.
Well, I'm not sure, because I'll show later that galaxy people find the young population in ellipticals, and many of them find populations of the order of 1 gigayear, many ellipticals. So I'm not entirely convinced that there are very long time delays. I'll show you.
Right. But I mean, if indeed to make a fair sample, you know, a real fair sample of the, you know, of the masses of galaxies, you need to weight the spirals by a heck of a lot more than typically is done in these surveys, then this is going to change that redshift distribution.
I don't understand, because this, there you have to look at one fixed field. They're not selecting galaxies. It's like a rolling.
So you're saying the goods survey is not, is a completely fair sample?
Yes. I mean, at least they're not selecting galaxies. They're just looking at a fixed piece of the sky, like the sunrise people.
Yeah, that's true.
Is not magnitude limited in any way?
Well, yeah,
but that does
it
itself introduce bias, right? Since the ellipticals are brighter and bigger.
I mean, I thought that was the point of some of the things that we heard earlier.
It's magnitude limited by supernovas.
Supernovas. So there's one supernova we all post.
So but the question is then, so you find a supernova, and do you know whether it's in a galaxy equally well if the host was a spiral versus an elliptical, or are you less likely to find the host if the host was a spiral?
Peter Nugent isn't here. He might argue that in fact you're less likely to find it in a large elliptical because the background is hot. But I
you
think
wouldn't
the
have
first
found
order
the supernova.
That they're equally likely no matter what kind of galaxy they went on. So this is irregardless of what galaxy, this is a volume sample of galaxy.
Yeah, so, in view of this result, we can see these are the typical values they get, 2.4, 3, 2.4, 2.6. And in some cases, they can exclude 10 degrees younger than 1 gigayear. So what we did is to do the same analysis, choosing the different subformation histories I showed in the beginning. So in this case, I use an arbitrary parametrization. This is the Jabalisco metal optical subformation history. This is the infrared and the fossil records subformation history. And you can see that the variation probabilities shift several gigayears even to negative values when indicated on this subformation history is not correct. And in fact, it has been corrected now and goes up. You can also, instead of using bias and probabilities, since the distributions are so wide, it's difficult to tell where's the 95% confidence level that you're going to choose. So you use KS tests and you have
Wait, can I be sure I understand what data you're using? So you're taking different star formation histories, that's fine.
Yeah.
But then you're taking 1A rate measurements as a function of redshift.
I'm taking the data, the supernova I showed you before. I'm taking this distribution of supernova. So the redshift distribution.
Just from one survey?
Yeah, just from the good survey.
Just from the good survey. So you're not using anything else but this data set?
Yeah, exactly. Because we just wanted to compare,
okay,
see what happens if you change the star formation history.
Okay, great,
that's why we use the same
great, thanks
parameterizations as well. So then you can use a KS test to do the same, and you find the same result. And
what was that page 04 again?
It's a Hagen et al. Paper. It's a Nature paper.
It's a fossil record.
It's a Nature session, please.
That's the fossil record paper.
What's the
paper? Oh, that's the same as.
Oh, that's fossil record.
Yeah.
Oh,
that's for all of us.
So I'm a little worried here. You're using the KS test as a goodness of fit here. That is, you're going to say that if the KS deviation is like greater than a certain amount, then you're going to reject the hypothesis.
Yes.
But that can't give you any parameter. Estimation confidence interval.
No, I just want to reject scenarios. That's the idea.
Okay.
So for this star formation history combined with the,
right.
The supernova, you will exclude time delays lower than 1 giga year with 95% confidence there. Why are we using a KS test? Because there are so few supernova that you have, we don't want to deal with.
But likelihood is, much better. And can do Bayesian inference with it. I mean, you can't use KS. You can only use KS to, you cannot use it to reject any parameter values or a range of parameter values. You can only use the KS to reject, a particular scenario as a whole.
Well, this is for different time delays. This scenario is, this subformation history, time delay.
I'm saying, but what you're doing is you're using it to restrict a range parameter values, and that's not appropriate use of KS. It doesn't work.
I'm not sure. I don't think so.
We'll talk about it afterwards.
Yes.
I'm very experienced in these matters, and you can't use it. You can't do that.
Well, that's
it's used all the time in astronomy, but it's not correct.
I think for this case, given that the supernova are very few.
Well, you can do is, you can take two distributions.
Yeah, we will take. Sorry.
Because it's not.
So, you can use e-folding distributions, exponential decays. There's no constraint. And again, yes. So, the main conclusion is that the later peak the star formation history, the shorter the time delay you will get. We also did, we tried to constrain the binary population synthesis time delay distributions for different combinations of star formation history and BPS parameters. So here are different star formation histories, single degenerate, double degenerate scenario.
Sorry, what are BPS parameters?
Binary population synthesis. So in this case, it's a common envelope efficiency. And, the first thing you can notice is that for this star formation history, the single degenerate channel will be excluded, but not for the others, with a more than 95% confidence level.
So the others together, not best correcting, taking some derivative, is it possible, and what's the other one? Different background?
Yes, the cosmic different background. Starting in about 2001.
So
they're all kind of indirect and wrong, but
it's a GO4M2 is the non-dust corrected.
Yeah, this is non-dust corrected. Yeah, no. And the second thing you can say that, well, all these models are consistent with a 95% confidence level. The best fit, the double degenerate scenario, with the infrared subformation history. But this is just a proof of concept, it's not. And you need better set constraints on the star formation history to start doing the same. And we found that doing Monte Carlo simulations, unless the star formation history is really well known, we won't be able to tell the time delay distribution based on this test. So you have very precise constraints, but not very accurate. So we did assume a star formation history and generated 1,000 random supernova. we derive the time delay using a different star formation history. So let's say the real star formation history is this one. And let's try to do the same analysis with a different star formation history. What would be the systematic effect of choosing the wrong star formation history? And we found it to be the order of 2 gigayears. So what I plot here is the Bayesian and probabilities for the 1,000 supernova random sample, assuming that the star formation rate history is the optical syndrome corrected one, but using a different star formation history to derive the data. So you can see for the single digit scenario, if you assume that the real star formation history is Chariot and Bass 2001, but you use this star formation history to derive the time delay, you will get time delays of the order of 2 gigayears, between 2 and 3. If this is the real one, but you use this to derive the data, you will get something of the order of 1.5. And if we assume the same one to derive the random supernova and the same one to derive the time delay, we will recover the single linear scenario time delays. And the same happens with the double linear scenario. So there's a systematic error of the order of 2 gigayears just because of the uncertainties in the star formation history. That's the main conclusion. That's the point I wanted to make in this talk. And the second thing is this supernova rate in elliptical galaxies. I don't think there has been much talk about this plot, De La Valle et al. 2005. So we have to explain why elliptical galaxies that are radio loud produce more supernova 1As than the ones that are radio quiet. Since radio loudness is usually associated to shorter timescales, there's probably some short time scale associated to this result.
Stefan, can I ask you a question about the observations of that? With the radio loud ones that produce a higher rate, do you know offhand if the supernovae that occur in them tend to be toward the center of the galaxy, or is there no correlation between the position of the supernova and the position of the center?
They have, in the paper, they have a picture of the host. I don't think they're particularly very close to the center, not aligned with the jets or anything like that.
What does this mean, x-axis?
Excuse me?
X-axis.
Or block
time. Ah, the morphology, yeah, ellipticals, spirals, irregulars. So it's a Manucci et al. Result, plus radio loudness and radio quality. So, star formation in elliptical galaxies. These are papers from the Galaxy team. So, please, I ask you to read them. It's very interesting what they're finding. So, the main conclusion they reach is that the UV color magnitude relation allows them to identify the last important episode of star formation in galaxies. Significant fraction of massive early type galaxies at low redshift exhibit levels of star formation are detectable in the optical but visible in the UV. Just repeating that. And the low limit of the fraction of massive early type galaxies showing signs of star formation rate, star formation is of the order of 30%. And early type galaxies in the redshift range 0 to 0.11 have 1 to 3% of the stellar mass in star less than 1 gigayears old. So if this is true, do we need the long time delays? There's some problem here.
Do you know why do they interpret this as main sequence stars and not evolved hot stars, like, as people have usually done, right? What's changed here? Because Yi, for example, a couple of years ago, was all talking about SDB stars.
Right.
What's changed? Why is it suddenly main sequence stars?
I don't know, I'm not an expert, but these are the results. And
just looking at you,
is this the UV upturn?
No, it's corrected by the UV upturn, it's corrected by the AGN activity.
The question is, what is the UV data? Is it the UV upturn in ellipticals that they're using, or is it something else?
It's the near UV. It's the color in the...
It's the UV upturn.
No, they say that...
The color index,
Color index, yeah.
It's a UV color magnitude, it's a color index, and in galaxy can only be the two.
Maybe they're not going quite so fast in UV, they're looking slightly nearer UV. Okay.
And they say that in optical, this is the year. You cannot tell the difference between age, metallicity, and dust. And the near UV is clear, according to them.
Yeah, but the question Tom's asking is basically, well, the other way of rephrasing the question would be one of, all I do is lay down a population of main sequence objects and ask how the color evolves as a function of time, right? But don't include anything further down the track in terms of binary interactions that might lead to things like SDBs, et cetera. Okay. Then you're missing out on contributions to the UV.
Well, it could be.
So they're not including binary evolution, for example, in some form, and they might just be missing something interpreting it as
younger stuff. I mean, we know in a few nearby ellipticals where HST has spectra of the UV upturn, that it's an SDB star spectrum. So it tells you that it is the result of binary evolution, not due to stars being formed recently. So I just don't know from these, if these are galaxy results, my memory was that these were all redos of the UV upturn, finding that it wasn't metallicity dependent. There had been an old result from IUE which showed that the UV upturn was metallicity dependent. Mm-hmm. But I think the Gallic shows that wasn't the case anymore.
I think so, yeah. I know that they are aware of the UV upturn. They talk about the UV upturn.
Mm-hmm. We discussed this, I guess, a few weeks ago anyway, yes. Right? I mean, this issue that as they look at ellipticals, mm-hmm. you do find evidence of dust and gas, and when you study the populations, there may be some degeneracy at optical wavelengths, but evidence of at least intermediate age populations. So it's at least consistent with what people find from other directions of evidence. Elliptical, certainly, you know, there are ellipticals with star formation, as Ed pointed out earlier when we looked at that one galaxy that had interactions, but I don't know that there's any evidence that ellipticals don't have star formation.
Like you said, I think that's fine. So 1-3% in stars, that's from the optical, I think you can say that too.
So I think the surprising thing is the last bullet is the one I think we've heard many times, that early type galaxies have had a few percent of their stellar mass formed recently. But the fact that 30%, the notion that 30% have high m-dots,
One to 1.5 giga years. That's okay.
But what's the m-dot over a mass? Yeah, that's the question.
By m-dot, you mean the star formation rate?
They said that it could be similar, the big elliptical could be similar to a Milky Way.
It can't be ongoing.
But does anybody know from Sloan, there was a lot of work done in Sloan from H-alpha, for nearby ellipticals. And Sloan had a tremendous amount of data. Does anybody remember that? There was a whole paper from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey about evidence from light emission. Star formation in ellipticals, and there was some. But then again, it was a few percent, is what I remember.
Yeah, I mean, I think the point here is that where are the corpuscles? So you have to be able to form the stars, and when the stars are forming, whether either you say that the galaxy is not elliptical, or the stars are forming another galaxy that merge. But something, there's some, we have to explain the absence of corpuscles.
I don't think so. If you look at the Sloan, something that the exercise that should be done is to take what we know from Sloan, the nearby galaxies, where you get the total star formation rate in ellipticals, and then ask, given that rate, should Kate have seen it? And I think the answer is no. Should they have seen it before? So the question is, the fact that you haven't seen it, it doesn't actually mean that it's been really constraining, that's all I'm saying. But that's an exercise that should be done from Sloan.
They compare with Sloan data all the time. I don't know, it's just to raise the problem because I haven't heard about this.
Is that 1-3% sufficient to justify the type 1 supernova rate in ellipticals? My impression was that you would have needed much more information.
This is probably the stars we see are the tail of some distribution. but I don't know how long is the distribution, so it depends on that. It depends on the time delay. Yeah.
And there's actually a lot of stars, a lot of mass, even though it's not a small percentage, it's a lot of mass, and the overall rate is lower, so, you know.
I think you stopped to explain why ellipticals seem to show peculiar and subluminous 1As. If this was the same population as in spirals, then you'd expect the same type of, the same distribution of super 1As.
Again, it depends on the time delay, though. Because again, in spirals, you get some that have shorter time delays, and maybe. Or you can, in principle, have some that come from more recent star formation than here. Just because you have young stars here doesn't mean that you're rich in the highest mass stars. But I don't know. We need to look at that in detail. I
really but that was, know. I mean, if that was a significant percentage, why don't you have 1 to 3 giga a year now?
So I think we might well know the answer. So if you take, in spirals, if you take the ratio of core collapse to 1As, it's 3 to 1. If that's also true for the star forming in ellipticals.
No, it's not.
I know it's not.
But
you see what I'm saying?
Yeah. My point is that when an elliptical is undergoing this star formation rate, I mean, this star formation rate, so do we call it an elliptical or do we call it something else?
We could call it an elliptical, but if you took a spectrum of it, you would see some star formation. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've done spectra, you know, you have an elliptical and you see an H alpha emission, but it's a small fraction of what you get from a spiral. So, yes, you have to be careful because morphology isn't the best way of doing it. But from what we've seen, you know, there are supernovae going off in galaxies that have very little or no star formation at all. And then looking at our populations, there are some, this is the Gallagher stuff, we can get ages of the populations, the dominant population, and they're, you know, 5 to 10 billion years old, and there are still 1As going off.
I know,
there,
yeah.
And there hasn't been.
But this is not the dominant population, that's the point.
Right, but there's no, I bet if Galax looked at those, I mean, you don't have Galax looking at the hosts necessarily. If Galax looked at some of these hosts, these ellipticals, they would not see any evidence of star formation, is my bet. Mm-hmm.
We should
Spencer
could do this too, as we were discussing.
Possibly.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, I think, Peter, your comment about it being subluminous is also an issue, because if you have 1 to 3%, you know, then, you know, and you have a factor of 30 or 50 lower rate in the ellipticals than you have in the star forming, then that would mean that all of these should basically be the same as in the star forming. They should not be subluminous. So. I mean, that also argues that it's not the whole story here. The other thing was in the Swift ones, we had this nice example of, quote, an elliptical with 2 1As going off in it, you know, and many going off in it recently, and it was some interaction. But those were, you know, I don't remember if any of those were subluminous.
I don't know either. I bet they were not subluminous.
That's what I'm guessing too, which is. Further evidence that this isn't, you know, if there's the star forming component, what you would expect to produce, you know, more normal luminosity 1As and not these subluminous ones.
I think in the end, the there's some star formation going on in ellipticals and it is contributing to some of the supernovae, but I think there's still an old population that is producing some.
Yeah, but the question would be how many of those? Yes. If you just take that right, how many of the supernovae and ellipticals will come from this star forming? And then whatever's left.
What was on that? The five part of the radio.
Maybe that's remarkable. How do you think that this is?
I don't know, maybe that's not estimate.
That's a difference.
What it could be. Some maybe factor, maybe half.
I don't know. So, well, continue. I don't know, sorry. There's another result from the galaxy people is that field ellipticals show less star formation. So that's also consistent with the Lavalle et al. Paper. So maybe we should look for this kind of signature in the type 1A rate to study star formation in ellipticals as contributing to the supernova rate. So conclusions, so, well, based on the time delays, none of the theoretical Pugendo scenarios can be ruled out with more than 95% confidence, but this is based on the time delays. Just because the star formation history is too uncertain. The Bayesian probabilities show peak at 3.5 giga years, and this is mainly due to the absence of supernova redshift greater than 1.5, so it's the last beam of the supernova rate. That is what is giving you this long time delays. So star populations of host galaxy may give you better constraints, but the recent episode of star formation are difficult to detect. The relevant ones are the order of 1 year. And so elliptical galaxies are not entirely passive. And the question is, how many long time delay type 1A supernova do we need? So that's what I want to say. Can I just ask one thing? So this is what I'm trying to say. So what if you have an elliptical galaxy that undergoes a merger, you have a short burst of star formation, and then you see the type 1A? So what happens if I put the type 1A here? Would I see this in elliptical or something else? So that's the main thing. And the other thing is that Ponce Lessi in 2006 says that most elliptical galaxies are blue and start forming a red greater than one, so I wouldn't be worried by the other ways results.
What is that? How does that turn into something?
What word is it? David and Matt's book.
Comment here, so because it's raised by whether these are happening in clusters or in the field, and whether ellipticals in clusters or in the field. And so I mean, this is the reason I thought about this is because of the short GRB business and how many are happening in clusters and so on. And are they happening in star forming or elliptical galaxies? And one of the things that isn't well widely appreciated in the GRB community is if you look at the morphology of galaxies in clusters at C of 1, it's about 50-50 between elliptical and spirals. But as you come to Z equals 0, then it becomes about 95% what are many people would call ellipticals and like 5% of the spirals. But what really matters for the short GRBs, and it may matter here, is a lot of what are termed ellipticals actually aren't ellipticals. They're lenticulars, which have had their gas fit, and they're just the bulge that's left when they go into the cluster. And those typically have recently been forming stars a lot, and they're not true ellipticals in the sense of the stellar population. They're actually spirals that have been stripped, and then have lost the gas. So. This is really can confuse matters tremendously if they're classified as ellipticals and think that they haven't formed stars for eons. No, they've been forming stars quite recently. So this may also relate to what one concludes from morphology in clusters versus the field. The field is much safer.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing, most of the galaxies are in the field, right? So most 1As that are detected in the field, not in clusters.
That's true.
So and so the clusters are a little more problematical, but as long as you stick with the field, it shouldn't be a problem.
I guess one issue, though, is there, what do we mean by an elliptical galaxy? I think that whole definition in terms of stellar populations in the past was based on incomplete data. So I think the idea that an elliptical is a system that only has old populations is something that is really a lot more subtlety to that. And so the so-called pure also, elliptical may not exist.
I mean, two things are, one is, what's the overall density of mass in the region, that you're, where the elliptical lies. And overdensities can vary from the field to the clusters where it's very overdense and things are different. But then also I would assume, like you're saying, that high redshifts, what's high, one or something higher than that, the frequency of mergers, of some small star-forming galaxies with the ellipticals probably, gets non-negligible.
Yes, contribution of 40% according to Rich et al. 2007. So, star formation rates.
But I mean, in that case, how much? What fraction of that 40% is one of the galaxies in an elliptical? I don't think it's so much.
Rick?